Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guests for this week's podcast are Raejean Preschold-Bell and Jason Biasi. Raejean and Jason recently wrote the book Faithful and Fractured, Responding to the Clergy Health Crisis, a book that seeks to answer the question, why are pastors in such poor health and what can be done about it? Raejean is Associate Research Professor of Global Health at the Duke Global Health Institute and the Duke Center for Health Inequalities. And Jason is the Butler Chair in Homiletics and Biblical Hermeneutics at Vancouver School of Theology, the author of several books, and a contributing editor to the Christian Century magazine. Jason and Raejean reflect on the unique vocation of being a pastor, the true joys of the job, but also the distinct challenges that can lead to poor emotional, spiritual, and physical health. This is a really good conversation, not only for clergy, but for those who work with and care for them. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Raejean and Jason, thank you so much for joining me on the Failing Boldly podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, we're glad to be here.
Good. Well, as I noted in the introduction, Raejean and Jason have written a really wonderful book called Faithful and Fractured, Responding to the Clergy Health Crisis. And so part of this book, it comes out of some studies done with the Clergy Health Initiative. So I'm wondering, Raejean, if you could first talk a little bit about that and how it led to this book.
Yes, our work with the Duke Clergy Health Initiative started 11 years ago. And it was because there was this general sense that clergy were less healthy than most people and that their health was getting worse. But the data didn't exist yet, not one way or the other. People hadn't collected it. Actually, there had been from the 60s a body of literature that pastors lived longer. And I think for that reason, there was that much more dismay that pastors' physical health in particular might be getting worse. But I have to say that at the very beginning, I was quite the doubter. I just thought, you know what? Everyone in America is getting less healthy. You know, obesity in the 2000s and 90s was skyrocketing. And the clergy conferences were concerned about health insurance rates, but everybody's health insurance expenses were skyrocketing during that time as well. And so I actually started the project mostly because there was a willingness to collect data. And I really thought we were going to find that pastors were on par with everybody else in America, or honestly, that they were healthier, because after all, pastors are educated. The group we were studying were employed. And there's a nice literature that being part of a religious community relates to having better health. So I was sure pastors were going to be healthier. And then they turned out they were not healthier, and that launched this long journey we've been on.
But fay tables are dangerous, Chris.
Indeed. And you do talk in the book about historically that clergy do live longer. And so I'm wondering, Jason, if you could talk a little bit about, this is a fairly big question, but talk about the nature of clergy and how that has changed, particularly in recent decades, and your own experience, but also kind of your own observations.
Yeah, Raejean didn't let me use this in the book, but I like to say church is so good for you that pastors are in worse health than the general population and live longer. says I can't say that because we're going to start dying sooner given these trends, and we don't have the data to say such things. And blessedly, she believes in data, and that's why the book is the way it is. It's her saying, okay, here are things that are true that I can show, and then me trying to speak theologically about it. And the nature of the pastoral life is to take part with God in the renewal of all things. It's massive. It's always been that big. There have been shifts, and others who are historians can say this more properly, but some of those shifts, the shifts are never 100%. So in the 60s, pastors started getting trained to do more therapy, more sort of social work kinds of things. That was never our full job, but it was part of it. That's still in the ether. I was never trained that way, but those books were still around. That was still part of how I was assumed to be learning to be a pastor. And as you tack on more jobs, I do think the job becomes more complex. And so, you know, there are leadership gurus who say being a pastor is the most complex job there is, CEO included of a major company, right? So we're expected to be good at all these things. And in truth, we're not good at most of them. We're hoping, trying to be good at one or two, and they're 25, you have to do well. And in an age when the mainline church is disintegrating, often it's clergy who are the easiest ones to blame, right? Like, we're the ones up there, we're the ones leading. But if you're a pastor, you went into it all excited because you wanted to serve God and you had this call and you love people and blah, blah, blah. And then pretty soon, wait, the church is awful and it's your fault. Why are you so fat? You know? So I don't know that it's any more dramatic now than it's ever been. In the ancient church, they often speak of doing battle with demons and, you know, the Roman Empire is trying to flay you alive. But in a way, they had a sense of why they were doing it. And so we have less of a sense of that. Like, wait, are we a social worker? Or are we trying to turn around a moribund institution? Or is it for God? Or, you know, why am I so unhealthy? So that's why a lot of my stuff is aimed toward what's the purpose of the church, not just what's the purpose of pastoring.
Regina, I'd love to hear you also comment on that and then talk a little bit about, I mean, you said it sounds like you went in thinking one thing, coming out of it another. And I'm wondering if there are particular parts of the study that surprised you. I mean, it sounds like generally you were surprised, but are there particular things that really surprised you?
Well, to comment on what Jason was saying, I mean, one of my initial surprises is the scope of the work that clergy have. And I think someone told me, you know, clergy are the last great generalists. And that stuck with me in a time when, I mean, there was a period of time where clergy started to specialize as well and get specific degrees and rules and regulations the way many professions do. But now everybody is specializing, it seems like. And so the parishioners are thinking clergy are very specialized and might have the misconception that clergy are only preparing for Sunday. And so one of my first surprises was like this long list of work that clergy do and the vastly different skill sets behind that. You know, there's community organizing and leadership of something that can be very difficult outside of the church. And then there's supervising the receptionist. And one of the quotes from our focus groups that really stick with me is this idea that you have an all-volunteer staff. And if you think about it, clergy work as a business. And with your volunteer staff, you are kind of training and bringing up volunteers, and you're hoping that people go in the positions where they'll serve the best. And a lot of times that happens, but sometimes that doesn't. And just kind of realistically, this one pastor in a focus group said that he'd been a CEO of a really large company, and he said, "I miss the days when I could assign employees to jobs where their strengths were, and if they didn't have the strengths, I could just fire them." And he was saying it tongue in cheek. I mean, like, he wanted to welcome every single parishioner into his church, but it is a difficult balance to do.
And it seems like you named some things, Regine, and Jason, you also did too, in talking about, you know, am I a social worker? What am I? And it seems like, on the one hand, that's speaking personally, that's one of the things I love about the job, is being able to try on all these hats. On the other hand, those skill sets seem to increase and multiply. So, for example, in recent years, entrepreneur seems to be something that people are putting on pastors too, to kind of try and create and start these new things. And so, these different skill sets keep getting added, but nothing really gets taken off.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, a couple, Regine always likes stories about the sound system. Those always seem to baffle her the most, right? But every pastor knows, if you can't get that thing to work, nothing else works, right? For me, it was also supervising other paid staff. I didn't know how to do that. I knew how I didn't like being supervised, but that just removes one or two routes. There's a million untaken routes. And the entrepreneur thing, I think is really smart people are trying with all of their energy to do one thing well in their lives.
Right.
And so as a pastor, you can end up feeling like, you know, on the best days you feel like, hey, these are all amazing things and I get to switch and I'm not bored by anything. On the worst days, you just feel like a hack at everything, you know? And then the thing you really got into it for, to love God, serve people, preach the gospel, bring justice, like, all ends up feeling like, why aren't I doing that anymore? I'm coasting in the thing that actually called me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised by what seems to stress pastors out. Like, I had assumed it would be the busiest times of the year. Mm. Lent, Advent, you must be going so many extra meetings and organization that I had thought that would be hard. But I actually think that those times of the year are full of meaning, and clergy are doing the work that they most want to do. And I now suspect that the times that clergy are having the harder times are the administrative periods, like when they're focusing on budgets and membership counts. And at those times, they just don't feel like they're making disciples of Jesus Christ. And that's draining. Necessary, but draining.
You remind me of a time when I'd worked and worked and worked, and we had something like 25 new members at our church of 1,300. And then at an administrative meeting, they cleared 50 people off the rolls. And I was like, man, I'm down twice what I brought in. This is impossible.
One of the things that I wondered a lot about was pastors and their social support. And, you know, pastors are surrounded by people often, all day long, and they participate in some of the most intimate moments of people's lives, the baptisms and the funerals. And the parishioners talk to them, and they really care about those. But we were hearing from pastors that sometimes they feel socially isolated. Maybe a good 15% say that they feel very or extremely socially isolated, even while they're around people. And so initially, you know, say in the first 5 or 8 years of the study, my team thought that that was because all the support was one way, going out from pastors to parishioners. But in the last year, really, we've been getting more of a handle on this through social networks data and 1,000 survey questions. And thank you to every pastor who answered our 1,000 survey questions. And we're now finding actually pastors do have a lot of people that they're turning to for support as we put the question. It's a lot of people. It's more than your average American. But nevertheless, pastors perceive that they are getting less social support than other people. And it turns out it's the perception of how much support you get that matters, and not your objective actual numbers of people who you can turn to for support.
Perception is just huge, I think, in churches and in ministry. And we have a really great staff person, or a really key lay leader at my church, who's more about objective data. And so she's helpfully always kind of pushing us to make sure we're not going too far with perception and really looking at how things are.
They both matter, you know,
they do.
In our data with pastors as well as around the U.S., like your financial stress, your perception of how financially stressed you are matters a lot. And in fact, that's a strong predictor of whether pastors are anxious or depressed, if you perceive that you're financially stressed. But if you objectively look at how much pastors or really anyone is earning, that doesn't predict that so well. And that's because people respond to debt in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can have a plan. Like, my hope for pastors is that if you meet with a financial counselor and you have a plan, that you can maybe reduce your financial stress even while the same amount of money is in the bank.
It's unreal to me, though. I mean, within our lifetime, if you went to seminary, some church would be like, oh, good, we'll pay for everything, and here's some extra spending money. And now you go to seminary and they'll charge you 30 grand and you borrow all of it, and health insurance costs 5 figures a year. And when are you ever going to recoup that? I mean, it's just all baked into the financial structure, and it doesn't really matter how you feel about it. Those are just the realities.
Yeah. Speaking of a kind of anxiety and stress, and I'm going to tie this in a little bit to, because the nature of this podcast around failure, quotes that you both wrote, I want to read, and I underline them twice because it so fits into kind of my own observations and perceptions. And for those who will read the book, it's a really, Regine and Jason do a really good job of not sharing the writing necessarily, but kind of giving, Regine writes about the study and her own reflections, and then Jason from a pastor's point of view, and also some theological reflections too. So Regine writes, talking about the nature of the ministry, she wrote, another implication of doing sacred work is that the stakes of perceived failure are higher for clergy than for other workers. The converse may also be true. Perceived success may be more meaningful to clergy. And so it's one of the things, and you mentioned this elsewhere in the book too, Regine, that whole sense of the highs are really high and the lows are just so low. And that's also been my own, in my own conversations and in my own experience too. So Regine, I was wondering if you could just reflect a little bit more on that particular thing that you wrote.
It is really interesting. Compared to most Americans, pastors feel more positive emotions and they feel more negative emotions all in the same week. And I really respect them for that, because a lot of people turn off to certain emotions, or they try to protect themselves, but not pastors. They run right up to it and say, I am here. And that is special. But it can also, I think for me, it's something that people don't talk enough about too. We also assume that someone's depressed or they're doing really well. And it turns out that you can kind of be doing both at the same time. And this is not to say all pastors are depressed. It's in our own studies, it's like maybe 9% or 11% who might qualify that I'd want to get screened more closely. But at the same time that you might be struggling, there might also be lots of joy in your life and satisfaction, and you might be interested in doing more work. And so when it comes to doing this sacred work, I do think pastors should be continue to dare to feel all of those difficult emotions, but also make sure that they're staying as open as possible to all the positive emotions.
What I found helpful is just naming, just right, putting it in black and white there as I was reading it too, was somewhat of a confirmation, like, oh, that's why I feel there. Some days I just feel like this is the best job in the world. And other days where I say, I'm going to go in the wine nuts tomorrow. There's got to be something better than this.
And I do think the sacred work of the nature means that it's really hard on a practical level to know when to stop. You know, yeah. I think that can be challenging for a lot of people, but when you're worried that stopping means saying no to someone who has sought you out for anything, because I'm sure as a pastor you've learned that the most important moments might start with a really innocuous question. And so not knowing when to stop or when to turn away, I think is a challenge, in that with sacred work like this, that pastors have to stay open to people and while at the same time protect themselves and figure out when on occasion they need to rejuvenate.
Yeah. Jason, you in part of your reflections in the book, I really appreciate your vulnerability and sharing out of your own experience and out of your own stories. I could literally feel your pain as you were sharing these things and talking about those highs and those lows. And you also talk about those moments when, for example, I think you named a parishioner, I think it was, or the name you gave her was Beth. And so these emails perhaps that you were experiencing, and though even though so many of the things were going well, just those little things really affected you. So I'm wondering if you could talk about what it meant for you to share so openly and being so vulnerable as you were writing this. Did that come easily for you, or was it a struggle?
No, it's hard. And I have some ambivalence about it. Henry Nouwen wrote this wonderful book, Wounded Healer, about his own pain and how ministry always comes out of your woundedness. And the danger of that is that we turn the pulpit into therapy, right? Like, let me tell you something else horrible that happened to me. That's not preaching. That needs to be taken care of in our own way. So we can share scars, not wounds, as some people say. So my church in North Carolina, I preached on Mother's Day the first year at Boone Methodist. And they were like, that was great. How about next year you tell us about your own mom? And I said, all right, you asked for it. So my own mom was a really troubled person, mental illness, substance abuse. She died of an accidental overdose in her 50s. So I told that story and talked about some stuff. And the same people came back to me and said, so that was nice. How about never talking about her again? So it's a thing. I've tried to figure out how to, when to bring that out, when not to, because it's kind of overwhelming, but it's sort of lying not to tell that story. And there are times when it's useful in terms of offering care to someone else. So I don't know. It's I never know if I've done it, told that story right, or honored her, or helped somebody, or then if it's just about me and not the person I'm talking to. So I also tried not to turn the book into therapy, right? But writing has a little bit more permission for that than preaching is about the gospel. It's not really about us. And I thought a lot of us get into this business because we have some terrible pain, right? Mm-hmm. So naming mine and talking about that seemed helpful. And the emails, you just remind me, I'd get home from a great Sunday. I'd be on kind of the Sunday high, and I'd be ready for the best nap in the world. Sunday afternoon naps are the reason to be in ministry, right? And then I'd be like, wait, things are going too well. Some heinous email is coming. I can feel it, right? And then you check email and there it is, right? Yeah. Like, here's something terrible you did, or you forgot this, or you embarrassed me, or I'm mad at you, or, and then it's in your head for weeks, right?
Going along that, in a section of the book, Jason, there's a section called Don't Waste Your Pain, and you touched on this a little bit, Regine. So I'm wondering if you could both talk a little bit about if you think that clergy respond to pain differently than, say, non-clergy types. So we in the clergy talk about how we respond to pain in difficult times in our lives. So we may write or preach about it, and people may think, wow, they really have it all together, but may not always practice it in the healthiest of ways. So I'm wondering if you could both reflect on that a little bit. How do pastors respond to pain?
And Jason, I think I'm going to let this one lie with you. I'm not sure that I really know. The data show that pastors do feel more difficult emotions than the average person, but what do you do with that?
I mean, you remind me of like other species that see more colors than we humans do, apparently, right? Like pastors just seem to feel more profoundly in a couple of different directions. And I think you want that. I don't think you'd be good at this work without feeling profoundly. I don't think people want pastors who are insensitive to the wide spectrum of human emotion and experience. I tend to think pastors that I notice flourishing have good friendships with whom they are themselves fully, who remind them who they are. And those aren't always with non-parishioners. At some point, the boundaries rhetoric made it sound like you couldn't be friends with parishioners. I just don't buy it. Jesus says, I've called you friends. Apparently, he's a bit of an authority on these matters. I don't know. Generally, pastors that I notice flourishing have had some experience in therapy and know what they're doing there, and they know how to kind of take care of that part of their lives so it doesn't sort of unexpectedly creep over and influence things in ways they're not aware of. And the wasting the pain thing, Chris, I was just struck. I mean, you and I both pastored people from the greatest generation who have mostly died now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I talked to World War II veterans for whom their experience in France was immensely painful, but also like the most profound experience in their lives, right? Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, how come we pastors whine so much about our conference? And this guy's talking about the bullet still in his shoulder from the bulge.
Yeah.
And my immediate thing was to beat up us pastors. Like, why are we so whiny? But actually, I don't think that's the right response. I think it's more a realization that American GIs fighting World War II knew what they were doing, why they were sacrificing, and therefore it was morally profound, even though it was painful. Hmm. So I think pastors often forget the why we're doing it, what it's for. The revolution God is hatching to repair the cosmos is one we get to take part in. It's far more meaningful than World War II, but we sort of lose that horizon. And if you lose that horizon, then the emails will eat you alive, right?
Yeah, that meaningfulness in work, like there is, we do know that meaning for most people in any profession, that the more meaning you have in your work, the longer you stay with it, but also the happier you are as a person. So I think that does come with the pain. But Jason, you were talking about the whining, and I hope that a lot of pastors don't whine. I certainly have met a lot of them who do not, Jason aside. But I will say, because it is it sometimes feels like it's in the water, like I'm burned out or you burned out. Let's be careful to not get burned out. I wonder if it's out there, in part because of researchers like me who have found pastors talking about burnout. So we did a study a couple years ago with Chris Adams and Holly Huff, and I was really excited. The team looked at the same kind of way of measuring and thinking about burnout across all these professions. There's a measure out there that's been used across many professions, and we said, okay, who would we want to compare pastors to? And we said, all right, let's compare them to social workers and teachers and counselors. And then let's also compare them to some people who have that adrenaline rush that Jason just mentioned on Sunday. So let's compare them to EMT workers and police officers. And then there are over 20 studies on clergy. So not just our data from North Carolina on United Methodists, but different clergy groups across the world. And we could compare them all in the same measure. And what we found is that clergy are on average doing the same in terms of burnout as social workers, counselors, and teachers. And they're doing better than police and EMT. They might be doing a little worse than counselors on a couple of things. Maybe there's something to learn about counselors. Maybe counselors can bound their time. But I'd love that to sit with your listeners for a second. Like, it's both like, yes, pastors can experience burnout. And no, they're not doing any worse than social workers and teachers. So that means they're doing pretty well. That means a lot of people in different professions can learn from pastors about how to do this really meaningful and sometimes administrative and not meaningful work all at once and still do really well.
Yeah. Later in the book, you begin to talk about what are practical things that clergy can do to flourish in their own vocations. And I want to talk about one chapter in particular, chapter 6, called Feeling Alive. And then pretty early on, you talk about, like, one of the subsections is positive emotions, what they do and undo. I must confess, when I first started reading this, I felt like, oh my gosh, is this like the secret? Like, just putting the good thoughts out in the universe and everything will be better. And that's not what it's about. So I was wondering, Regine, if you could, and this is actually the section, these are the sections that I kind of read and reread, particularly the work that Barbara Fredrickson does. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and describe that chapter and what can happen when folks have a positive mental outlook.
Oh, good. I would love to. So Barb Fredrickson is a social psychologist at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, has a whole body of work over 20 years. One of the things that I'd love us to consider that work in light of clergy and the pastor profession. And she's got this theory called broaden and build. Now she has a lot of data to support this theory. In a nutshell, what it is that when we humans experience positive emotions, it allows us to broaden out our thoughts. Like, in studies, once a small dose of positive emotions, I'm talking like 30 seconds of a penguin video, that can cause you to be more likely than the people who didn't see that video to donate your time, volunteer, donate blood, donate money, sign a petition, hang out afterwards and talk to strangers, more likely to consider people who are a little different from you. You're more likely to include them in your circle of people who are like you. In many ways, these are things that we want our leaders to do. We want them to be social. We want them to think of new ideas. So like the penguin video, you see that, and then you're given a problem to solve, and the people who had positive emotions induced write more a list of more solutions, and people judge those solutions to be more creative. That's what happens in the very short term. But in the long term, people who have slightly more positive emotions each day, that starts to add up. It adds up in that you're willing to take more classes, you talk to more people, you hear their ideas, you think about them with your ideas, you take a few risks, and over time you end up with better physical health, better mental health, more friends and social support, which is only going to serve you well in mm-hmm. ministry or anything, and more skills, even better jobs out there in some of the literature.
And it seems like, too, it just really helps build resilience over the long term. I mean, part of what we talk about in the podcast is not just failure, but then how do we respond to it? And it seems like this kind of thing can help build that up. I want to share just a brief example from my own experience. And Jason, I'd love to hear you, too, and how you put this into practice. In my email software, I have a little folder that I've created called Warm Fuzzies. And so whenever I get a complimentary or affirming email, I just shift it over there. And so on those days when I have either the failure or that get that email where it tells me that I don't know why you do this for a living, I can go over to that folder and remind myself, like, oh, I'm not a total loser in this occupation. There are those who appreciate and know that I have gifts for this. And it does. I think it does help in the long term. And so, Jason, I was wondering, how do you put this into practice?
You know what, Chris? I do the exact same thing. I wonder if we got it from some common source. I do think because criticism will linger with me for days. I mean, you can preach a fantastic sermon and everyone tells you how great it was, and then one person will say that you spelled something wrong in the bulletin, and that's what goes home with you, right? So I do think, but keeping things that are specific to the vocation, right? Like, it's not just someone compliments you, it's that someone else has gotten energized by the gospel to do something they couldn't have done on their own through the church's ministry, right? So the kind of thing where you're barely there, like God works almost despite you, but certainly it's not anything that was your idea. Those are the things that's magic, right? Mm. Like, that's worth a lifetime. And so I don't know why you remind me of this progression, because I don't think I write about it in the book, but I've always gone to Trappist monasteries, and I love Thomas Merton. I love this place in South Carolina, Mepkin Abbey. And then at some point, I think I was getting criticized at the church because I was gone too much. So I was like, well, let's just make it a church field trip. So I got like a bunch of lay leaders and some pastoral staff, and like a dozen of us went. So all of a sudden, we're all getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to chant psalms in the dark, right? And suddenly it's both, I'm not getting criticized because it's a church thing, but also I'm watching them come alive in their prayer in a way that I also had. And now their relationship with that monastery is ongoing. I've been gone from that church for 3 years. So something's happening that I helped engineer, but I didn't make the monastery. In fact, I was just trying to get the critics off my back. Right? I don't know. I think there are ways of being rejuvenated for the profession that go beyond kind of the small confines of our own psychology.
Yeah.
And if I fear sometimes, like, boy, I really hope that there's two chapters in the book about, first one's positive emotions, and then there's one on the flourishing study that we did with clergy. But I don't ever want it to sound like you just think positive thoughts, because actually you can't force yourself to think positive thoughts, and it doesn't work. And so actually what Barb Fredrickson suggests instead is just to tell yourself to be open. So even when things are hard, be open to a person, to what someone's saying, to an idea, but be open to the nature you see around you, to what your body needs. Maybe you should be open to going to bed early. But I think being open then actually puts you on the trajectory where you're more likely to be able to receive true positive emotions that are there. They have to be genuine or it doesn't work.
But this is also why our profession is so cool, because our job is to say, what's this mean in light of who God is and what God's doing in the world? That's the whole job. So that's a way of being open, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, again, we forget that so often.
Yeah. You've both talked, going back to the practicality of the book and what people can actually do, and you both talked about it a little bit. So I would, if you could both just succinctly talk a little bit about what would be the top three things that you would recommend to clergy for them to be able to live into a healthier space. And I assume Penguin Videos is probably not one of those top three, but it could be. Is that right, Rachel?
That's right. It won't make it.
Okay.
I'd say if you're a parishioner, see your pastor as a person sometimes. I mean, not always. They're there for you. They're certainly embodying being a pastor, but, you know, ask them how they're doing, if they're having a vacation, if what's on their minds, because we found in our studies that pastors who feel cared about as an individual and also as a pastor, that they do a lot better in terms of mental health. That's one. Okay. Another for pastors, I would say, keep one close friend. Mm-hmm. You know, three would be better, but keep one, maybe someone who knew you before seminary. Mm-hmm. But keep that person in your life, someone who you can be truly yourself with. And life is so busy. There's so many demands on all of us, and especially, I believe, on pastors, that if you have any kind of kind of like annual ritual, like one weekend a year when you get together, like staying in touch then will make it easier to be in touch later. And then I would say, give your work up to God. Hmm. You know, God is working through you, but not you alone. And so we found that pastors who are really flourishing judge themselves on the process that they bring to the work and not on today's outcomes.
That's really important.
You remind me of Greg Jones asking Wendell Berry what seminaries should be sure to do when Berry was at Duke one time. And he said, teach pastors a trade. That way they'll know they'll eat even if their church fires them, and they'll be courageous and tell the truth. Hmm. I think there's something to that. There's skills we can work at that can make us more fully alive. That can be a hobby. That can be part of our ministry. Echoing Ray Jean on friendships, I talk about my friend Wade in the book, who basically said, hey, I'm going to be at your house at 6 a.m. We're going running. And there wasn't really an option for me to say no. So we were out doing something physical, getting to know one another as friends. And I got healthier, by the way. Mm. Right. Mm. On keeping in touch with friends, Jalen and I, my wife Jalen's also a Methodist pastor, have several sets of friends that we vacation with or go on retreats with or talk on the phone with regularly. And some of them we weren't even that close to in seminary. But as our lives have gone on in ministry, they've become more and more important to us, life-saving to us. And so we measure things over decades. Yeah, that was a hard decade for her. Or look, wow, she's doing great now. Aren't we glad that she stayed with ministry when it was difficult, you know? So it does give you a sense of kind of patience. And as Regina is suggesting, you're not taking your temperature based on making budget this year or the kind of current crisis. Ministry is slow work. God's so patient. I mean, I wish God would go ahead and make all things new, but apparently God's asking us to join in God's unbearable patience with creation.
Yeah. Well, I usually end my podcasts asking guests to share a failure story out of their own lives. And so, Jason, you do a little bit of that in the book, but I'm not going to let you off the hook. I'm going to ask you to do that. But I'm going to start with you, Regine, because you are a little bit more perhaps analytical in the book. So I want to hear from you in your own life. Share with us a failure story from your own past.
Okay, great. There are so many to choose from, but I'm gonna bring in one that shows you what it's like to be part of my family and how well I manage that or don't. So, in North Carolina, we get tornadoes occasionally, and we start to have sirens now, so you can hear the sirens any time of the day. So, I'm thinking of a time when the sirens were going off, and it was a Saturday afternoon. So we are all awake. There is no excuse not to get in the basement because it's not like the middle of the night or anything like that. So we're all awake. So I tell everyone, all right, the tornado alarm is going off. We are all getting in the basement now. My husband's like, well, there's this soccer game going on TV, and I'll just stay right here on the sofa and I'll watch. And if I see the tornado, I will join you in the basement. I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay, never mind. I'm taking the kids and we're going to go down in the basement. And so So I get my son, who is probably about 15, and I get my daughter, who is probably about 9, and we go down in the basement. We're all just like sitting there in the basement. I'm like, oh, well, you know, maybe we'll do some storytelling. Maybe this can be some good family time. And suddenly my daughter's like, the dog. I'm like, okay, all right, go get the dog. So she gets the dog, and she brings the dog down. And then my son's like, I'm uncomfortable. I need a blanket. So he goes and he gets a blanket. And then they're like, oh, this is boring. I need a phone to play the game on. And they go and get the phone. And my son's like, my back hurts. And he goes and he gets a chair. And then like the Wi-Fi won't work down in the basement. And like before I know it, I've given them permission to go back upstairs to go get the next object that they're just absolutely sure they have to. And they don't come back. And I have this moment. I'm like, and the headlines read, Mother Saves Herself.
But her children had Wi-Fi.
That's right. And that is when it comes to my failures, I lead by doing, I give people a lot of autonomy, but I am so bad at saying, you just have to stay down in the basement.
That's great. Jason, how about you?
Remembering when my wife Jaylynn was pregnant with our first, and she thought she was going into labor. She wasn't. It was kind of, you know, Braxton Hicks contractions or whatever. And I'm in the other room typing on my prelim exams for my doctoral work. And I hear myself say, hold on a minute, honey. I just need to finish this paragraph.
Jason!
Not a great moment in human history. But I got to. The other is I think I've left jobs too early a couple different times. I think there's still a kind of Methodist rhythm that says, hey, I've been here a little while. We've done some stuff. What's next? I'm reminded of a UCC congregation in Maine I got to know where the associate had been there 25 years and the senior had been there 23 years. Mm. And the associate, she said to me, I think they're starting to trust us.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, by the time we Methodists traipse off, often they figured out our weaknesses, we figured out their weaknesses, like the marriage has just started to mature, and then we, you know, bail. So I just, it's not an ironclad rule, it's a rule of thumb. Lingering when it gets difficult is the right thing to do.
Mm, yeah. Well, Regine Pushall-Bell and Jason Biasi, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. And again, the book is Faithful and Fractured and highly recommended for folks, for clergy, but also for those who love them.
Chris, thank you so very much.
Yes, this has been great.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Regine and Jason for speaking with me. You can learn more about the Clergy Health Initiative by going to clergyhealthinitiative.org, and you can follow Jason on Twitter at Jason Biasi. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.